Okay, we have the next case on calendar is Byrne versus Sunridge Builders, Inc., case number 77668. And the argument is set for 15 minutes aside. My understanding is that we have Mr. Moloff on the telephone as counsel for the appellant, and then we have a number of lawyers and Robert Bob Bull as counsel for the appellant as well. And then we have four lawyers listed as counsel for the respondents. How are respondents' counsel planning to divide their time?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Bruno Wolfenson for Green Planet. We have decided to split our time 5 minutes apiece.
Okay, very well. And so the clerk will track it that way. And then counsel for the appellant is going to lead off by telephone, as I understand it. How much time do you want to reserve?
You're muted.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I would like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Very well. Can you see the... Well, I don't think you can. You will not be able to see the clock from the court, or is that correct?
No, we can see the clock, Your Honor, and even though we're connected, the audio is connected through the telephone, we are on camera, and we can see all of you.
Okay. Very well. Then you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, Counsel, my name is Lee Moloff of the law firm Moloff, Ball, and Reno. Mr. Vol, my partner, is at the table with me here today as well. This is a case of statutory construction and the interplay between various provisions contained within the Chapter 40 construction defect statutory scheme. As was amended in 2015 in Assembly Bill 125, the primary amendment to the statutory scheme was reducing the period of repose in the statute of repose to bring a construction defect complaint. So the 2015 legislature reduced the statute to 6 years, uniform across all kinds of defects. Previously, there was a scale of different periods of repose, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, and so forth, depending on the nature of the defect, the knowledge of the contractor. The 2015 legislature made this reduction in the statute of repose retroactive, but to mitigate against prejudice, which retroactively applying a reduced statute would cause some parties, they added a grace period of 1 year to run from the effective date of the legislation. Now, the overriding policy of Chapter 40 construction defect litigation and the statutory scheme is to promote and foster out-of-court resolution of construction defect disputes. And contained within Chapter 40 are a number of specific provisions and steps which a claimant must go through before they can bring a complaint alleging the construction defects. For example, Chapter 40 provides that a prospective claimant must serve a notice of claim defects on the contractor by certified mail return receipt requested. The contractor then has the right to inspect the property to determine whether or not they agree or disagree with the claimant's listing of defects. The contractor can also seek and choose to repair the defects all before a complaint can be filed. If these steps do not result in a resolution of the dispute, then there is mandatory mediation, and in certain circumstances, that mediation can be waived. Additionally, in furtherance of that same policy of having these disputes resolved outside of the court, There is the tolling provision contained in NRS 40.695, which provides that the statute of repose can be tolled for the earlier of 1 year after notice of the claim is given, or 30 days after mediation is concluded or waived in writing pursuant to NRS 40.680. And what triggers the tolling is the service of the notice of claimed defects. Now, the district court ruled that because the notice of claim in this case was served after the 6 year statute of repose that the court, or that the legislature reduced, because the notice of claim was served after the expiration of that time, that therefore the case, the claim was barred from filing. The facts which, upon which the district court relied are quite simple. The notice of claim was filed outside of the 6 year statute, but it was filed within the grace period that the legislature had put in AB 125, section 21, subsection 6. The complaint itself was filed outside of that grace period, but well within the extended tolling period. So the issue in this case becomes whether the tolling provision of 40.695 applies to a notice of claim served within the 1 year grace period provided by section 21, subsection 6. Now, we believe that section 21.6 is clear on its face and it's unambiguous, that it provides a statute of repose upon which the filing of a notice of claim would trigger the tolling. But if the court sees that this is ambiguous, we then look to the legislative history, the intent of the legislature, and the entire statutory scheme for its meaning in an attempt to harmonize the statute's meaning with the other statutes contained within that scheme. Statutes should be interpreted in a manner that produces a reasonable result. Statutes must be interpreted in harmony with other rules and statutes and read in context with a view to their place in the whole statutory scheme. So let's take a look at what the legislature did. In section 21, sections 5 and 6, they need to be read together. Section 5 reads, except as otherwise provided in subsection 6, which is the grace period, except as otherwise provided in subsection 6, the period of limitations on actions set forth in NRS 11.202 as amended by section 17 of this act applies retroactively. Then what the legislature did is provide subsection 6, which reads, the provisions of subsection 5 not limit an action, A, that accrued before the effective date of this act, was commenced within 1 year after the effective date of this act.
Mr. Moth, could I pause you right there? I'm a little concerned about the literal wording of subparagraph 6, which refers to the commencement of an action. And I take your point that you should read words not just in isolation in the particular provision you're looking at, but in the context as a whole. It, reading chapter 40, it does distinguish between the notice of claim and the commencement of an action, and it does that fairly consistently. So we would have to revise this subparagraph to say not commencement of an action, but the filing of a notice of claim or commencement of an action to credit your position. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor, I disagree respectfully. All of the statutes of repose, I should say none of the statutes of repose that were used previously to this had a specific reference notice of claim. The statutes of repose simply said that You would be time-barred in filing an action if you didn't do so by a specific date set forth. Just because subsection 6 doesn't mention the notice of claim doesn't mean it's still applicable. The language dealing with commencing an action is what's in every statute of repose without reference to a notice of claim. So that's how I would answer your question, Your Honor.
What do you make, I'm sorry, of NRS 40.6451A, which says before a claimant commences an action, the claimant must give written notice. And then it says notice is not required before commencing an action in certain instances. I guess I'm circling back to the same question again. When the statutory scheme actually describes notice as distinct from commencing an action, how can we just not follow what the legislature wrote?
Well, I think you can follow what the legislature wrote. Just because it doesn't mention notice of claim in 21 subsection 6 doesn't mean that the effect of serving a notice of claim has the triggering effect of 40 section 695, which triggers the tolling of the statute of repose upon service of the notice of claim.
This is Justice Kadish up here in Carson City. Isn't it true, though, that the tolling only applies if the notice is served within the statute of repose, right? You can't serve a notice after the statute of repose and somehow jump back into the repose period.
That's correct. And in our case, the notice of claim was served within the extended statute of repose created by subsection 6.
But that only applies if you commence the action within the one-year period, which it sounds like commencing an action is filing in court, and that didn't happen within a one-year period.
No, it didn't. It happened within the tolling period created by the filing of the notice of claim, which was served within the grace period and the statute of repose created by Section 21.6.
Okay.
So just because the whole point is that the statute of repose is tolled, meaning that the complaint in this case, which was filed after the extended grace period, but it was still within the tolled additional period. I'm not sure I made that very clear, but the point is, just because file the notice of claim within the within the statute of repose period does have the effect of tolling the statute of repose, or under 4695, for the earlier of 1 year or 30 days after mediation is concluded, whichever is earlier. So, continuing on, if NRS, now, I'll reserve the last 3 minutes, Your Honors.
Very well, sir. I will leave it to Respondents' Counsel to announce themselves as they proceed.
Yes, Your Honors. Bruno Wolfenson on behalf of Defendant Green Planet. I'll be speaking first, and Chief Justice and Justices' counsel, if it please the court. I represent Green Planet, one of the defendants in this case. The issue and the arguments have really been made by the Chief Justice and by Justice Stiglitz as to the issue in this case. The statute is very clear that you must file an action. And the actual words in the statute are commence an action within that one-year grace period. And let's go back for a second to 2014 and 2015. The backdrop for this statute is that there was a political pendulum swing in favor of builders. There was a backlash against the plaintiff friendly statutes at that time.
Mr. Wolfenson?
And what?
Mr. Wolfenson?
Yes.
This is actually Justice Stiglitz. So that was Justice Kadish before. But that said, why shouldn't a plaintiff get the benefit of the tolling provision of 40.695 during the grace period? Why isn't the grace period an extension? And if they file that, why don't they get the benefit of tolling if they serve the notice during the grace period?
That is a great question, and that's the crux of this case. Mm-hmm. And the reason they don't is because that grace period is not a statute of repose to which notices act as a tolling on them. In fact, it's interesting. I think the appellant finally hit the issue on the head in their response brief when they directed this court to the Legislative Council Digest. And if you look right at the beginning in the Legislative Council Digest, where it explains what Section 21 is going to do, it says, Section 21 of this bill, 1, and this doesn't relate to us, provides that revised statute of repose set forth in Section 17 to 19 apply retroactively under certain circumstances. And 2, and this does apply to us, establishes a one-year grace period during which a person may commence an action under the existing statutes of repose. Now, if that language had actually made it into the statute that said this one-year period is a period under which you can bring an action under the existing statutes of repose, we, the defendants, would have a much more difficult argument saying that the tolling period and the entire statutory scheme under Chapter 40 didn't apply. But let's look at the language that the legislature actually came up with. It doesn't say that. If you look at Section 21, and we don't need to read Section 5 again, but if you look at Section 26, what does it say? It says, the provisions of subsection 5 do not limit an action commenced within 1 year after the effective date of this act. Well, where's the language talking about this is just a statutory repose period that this affects? It's not there. It doesn't exist. And you, as the judges, the justices in this case, aren't supposed to go in there and rewrite the language for the legislature, which is what plaintiff is asking you to do.
But to the extent you have at least a perceived conflict between in applying these statutes, why don't we defer to the fact that they say Chapter 40 is going to prevail over any conflicting law, and NRS 11 that says it also defers to it, except where there's different limitation periods prescribed.
Great question. And the reason we don't is because of the political backdrop under which this statute was crafted, which was to favor the builders and give them a specific limited period in which they could face litigation. And I know the Supreme Court has called this a grace period. I call it a due process savings clause. But what the legislature learned from previous court rulings was, hey, if we do retroactive execution of statutes of repose, we have to give a reasonable time for somebody to bring a case. And the way the legislature chose to do that was to give a one-year period in which to file an action. And as Chief Justice Pickering pointed out, that those terms are defined in this very statute under 40.645. So you're going to have to do a lot of verbal gymnastics to get around the issue that the legislature used specific language in this very statute and said what prescribed exactly what needed to be done, and that wasn't done.
But if in fact the tolling period, I'm sorry, if in fact they had commenced the action within the grace period without doing the pre-litigation process. It would have been dismissed without prejudice to do the pre-litigation process, except if it was going to blow the statute of limitations, in which case we'd be right back here. Correct?
Well, then it wouldn't have blown the statute of limitations. They would have been within the grace period. And I'm glad you raised that, and I've gone over my time. I apologize. But we had other attorneys in the community reach out to us during this particular period and say, hey, I know we haven't gone through the whole Chapter 40 process and we haven't complied with the notice, but we're filing our claim in conjunction with these notices. And our firm, you can look if you want, we never filed any objections to that because we understood what this period was, and so did the other side, so did the plaintiffs of that bar. And like I said, I've extended my time, but thank you for those questions, and I think you're right on the issues.
Who's up?
Thank you, Justices, Chief Justice. This is Robert Schumacher, and Brian Walters is with me. Counsel for Lands West. Lands West is somewhat differently situated than the other respondents in that it did not perform any original construction, and none of the defects that were within the Chapter 40 notice were attributed to Lands West. Moreover, none of the itemized damages were allocated to Lands West. Nonetheless, we concur for obvious reasons with the comments of Mr. Wolfenson. I'd like to expand on one of the points he was discussing at the end of his time, specifically the language in NRS 0.647. It states, and I quote, in subsection B, well, I better read the whole thing for context. If a claimant commences an action without complying with subsection 1 or NRS 40.645, the court shall A, dismiss the action without prejudice and compel the claimant to comply with those provisions before filing another action. Now, if that did occur, arguably the statute would bar the later filing of a complaint for constructional defects. However, importantly, subsection B goes on to say, if dismissal of the action would prevent the claimant from filing another action because the action would be procedurally barred by the statute of limitations or repose, the court shall stay the proceeding pending compliance with those provisions by the claimant. The effect of that, obviously, is that they would be within the applicable statute of repose, in this instance, that enumerated in AB 125. We agree with appellant's assessment or characterization of the case in that it's one of statutory construction. However, we disagree with the notion that there's any ambiguity within the statutory language therein. I think it strains credulity to overlook the statute where it goes into the differences between a notice, which we know a Chapter 40 notice is served, it's not filed, and the commencement of an action. I'd like to bring the court's attention to NRS 40.652. That's the offer of judgment section in the statute. It says in subpart 1, at any time after a claimant has given notice pursuant to NRS 40.645, that's the Chapter 40 notice, and before claimant commences an action or amends a complaint to add a cause of action for a constructional defect, and then it goes on. Clearly, there is no reasonable interpretation other than the one I think that was suggested by the Chief Justice and Justices Stiglitz and Kadich, that there is an obvious distinction intended by the legislature where the notice is the notice and that commencement of the action is tantamount to the filing of a complaint. We know that the complaint was not timely filed within the language of AB 125.
Mr. Schumacher, why shouldn't the plaintiff get the benefit of the tolling period for the service of the Chapter 40 during the grace period? Why do they lose that?
Because the statute of repose had already expired. So, as I think it was Justice Kadish suggested, you can't, by the filing of a complaint, revive something that's already dead. You cannot toll something that has already, you know, ran its course and expired.
Mr. Schumacher, I'm eating into your colleague's time. I want you to address, if you would, the recovery of attorney's fees. I understand that it's a discretionary standard, but I don't understand why Sunridge's motion was denied and Land West was granted, and how that can be explained.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I think it can be easily explained in that, as I mentioned at the outset, the Lands West is differently situated than Sunridge. Specifically, Lands West did not do any original construction. Lands West did not pull the building permit. Lands West, none of the defects were in the Chapter 40 notice were attributed to Lands West. None of the damages itemized by plaintiff's counsel were attributed to Lands West. At no time were there any defects or any monetary damages or damages of any sort attributed to Lands West. And therefore, and that's why at the lower court we brought the motion not only under Chapter 40 in NRCP 68, but also NRS 18.010. Personally, I felt the court should have granted the motion for attorney's fees on that basis as well. There was no fact, no reasonable basis for the homeowner to name and sue Lands West.
What about the alter ego successor liability issue? In that respect, that allegation would make it the same as Sunridge plus showing alter ego.
Understood. However, there never was articulated any facts. There were no facts that existed at that time that would suggest an alter ego theory or cause of action claim was viable.
Did the district court consider that? Sorry for the delay. Did the district court consider the alter ego or successor liability? In other words, did the court find there is no facts to support that as part of the evaluation of whether to award fees?
My recollection, Justice, is that it was part of the motion practice, the briefing at the lower court level, that it was discussed during oral argument. There was subsequent briefing ordered by the lower court. But I do not believe that in the detailed order issued by Judge Scotty that was a specific finding of the court. I base it on my recollection.
Thank you.
Okay. Are you prepared to yield the balance of your time to your co-counsel?
Yes.
I will add 2 minutes to the clock so that your co-counsel can be heard, and I will add the same to Mr. Moloff's clock when he resumes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. This is Roger Strasberg speaking for Sunbridge. The only thing I would have to add is the question's been asked, why shouldn't plaintiff have the benefit? And I think the reason is the Constitution. The effect of a statute of repose is to create a substantive right that vests, becomes unconditional upon the running of the period of repose. That is, under Al Zenz, a substantive right that cannot be impaired but by due process. And the only due process provided in the statute appropriately is the commencement of an action under Section 6. That was not done here. And so the defendants, we are fighting to protect this vested right that the statute has afforded. As to tolling, the effect of the tolling statute, 695 says that it only takes effect from the time the notice is filed. That clearly implies that there is a subject matter on which it may take effect. In this case, there was none. The due process provided for the constitutional norms was not respected by the plaintiff. 647, an alternative, was not provided. I'd also direct the court to Section 3, which provides that in the case of cases where the statute of repose has expired, there must be a showing of good cause, and that was not followed either. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You have almost 5 minutes, Mr. Moloff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's look back at the statutes that we're talking about in SB 125, Sections 5 and 6. Section 5 says, except as otherwise provided in subsection 6. Section 6 says, the provisions of subsection 5 do not limit. They are mutually exclusive. So the language of these subsections that cross-reference each other also show that 21.6 constitutes its own period of repose. If it's its own period of repose, then 40.695, the tolling provision, does operate. By stating that the period provided in NRS 11.202 is separate from the period provided in subsection 6, the legislature made clear that subsection 6 contained its own period of repose. So if 11.202 doesn't apply to actions governed by the grace period, 21 subsection 6, the period of repose that does apply is the period set forth in subsection 6. And for what other purpose is the tolling provision but to make it easier for pre-litigation resolution of claims? That's the policy underlying these statutes and why subsection 6 should be read liberally. So if the grace period is correctly considered to be its own statute of repose, and it clearly fits the definition of one, a statute of repose is that it bars a cause of action if not brought within the specified time period. And we cited the case of FDIC versus Rhodes in our reply brief, which also stands for that position. A statute of repose isn't some defined term. It's how it operates. It operates to bar a cause of action. That's what subsection 6, subsection 6 of Section 21 of SB 125 holds. So based on that, I would ask the court to reverse the district court's ruling and remand it for further proceedings. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Moloff, I wanted to ask you about the attorney's fees that were awarded to Lands West. And as you've heard, obviously you're aware that Lands West is saying, look, we were never the general contractor. You knew we weren't the contractor. You knew we hadn't done the work you were complaining about, and that seems to be the basis for the court's finding under the Beatty factors under which it ultimately awarded fees to Lands West. So putting aside for a moment your arguments on the merits of the case, why isn't that right? Why shouldn't fees be awarded?
The district court did not really deal with the alter ego claims as was earlier discussed. The alter ego claims and the subsequent liability were legitimate claims. In looking at the Beatty factors, first of all, the offer was made very early in the case before any substantial discovery had been done, and the offer itself was $10,000 against a $1.3 million potential claim. Certainly, the appellant here, the plaintiff below, had every reason to reject that $10,000 offer, and in doing so was reasonable, and as such, the district court abused its discretion in really avoiding doing an appropriate analysis under the Beatty factors. And we'll stand on our brief with regards to the rest of that point.
Thank you very much. Does anyone in the North have any further questions of Mr. Moloff? Justice Gibbons?
No.
Thank you, counsel, for your briefs and oral argument in this matter. It will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the further call of the court.